Chapter 8. The health of the Allied armies of England and France, with all possible honors. And proposing the health of the treasurer, Mr. Dickens said, "If the president of this institution had been here, I should possibly have made one of the best speeches you ever heard. But as he is not here, I shall turn to the next toast on my list. The health of your worthy treasurer, Mr. George Moore, a name which is a synonym for integrity, enterprise, public spirit, and benevolence. He is one of the most zealous officers I ever saw in my life. He appears to me to have been doing nothing during the last week, but rushing into and out of railway carriages, and making eloquent speeches at all sorts of public dinners in favor of this charity. Last evening he was at Manchester, and this evening he comes here, sacrificing his time and convenience, and exhausting in the meantime the contents of two vast leaden inkstands, and no end of pens, with the energy of 50 bankers' clerks rolled into one. But I clearly foresee that the treasurer will have so much to do tonight, such gratifying sums to acknowledge, and such large lines of figures to write in his books, that I feel the greatest consideration I can show him is to propose his health without further observation, leaving him to address you in his own behalf. I propose to you, therefore, the health of Mr. George Moore, the treasurer of this charity, and I need hardly add that it is one which is to be drunk with all the honors." Later in the evening, Mr. Dickens rose and said, "So many travelers have been going up Mont Blanc lately, both in fact and in fiction, that I have heard recently of a proposal for the establishment of a company to employ Sir Joseph Paxton to take it down. Only one of those travelers, however, has been enabled to bring Mont Blanc to Piccadilly, and, by his own ability and good humor, so to thaw its eternal ice and snow, as that the most timid lady may ascend it twice a day, during the holidays, without the smallest danger or fatigue. Mr. Albert Smith, who is present amongst us tonight, is undoubtedly a traveler. I do not know whether he takes many orders, but this I can testify, on behalf of the children of his friends, that he gives them in the most liberal manner. We have also amongst us my friend Mr. Peter Cunningham, who is also a traveler, not only in right of his able edition of Goldsmith's Traveler, but in right of his admirable handbook, which proves him to be a traveler in the right spirit through all the labyrinths of London. We have also amongst us my friend Horace Mayhew, very well known also for his books, but especially for his genuine admiration of the company at that end of the room." Mr. Dickens here pointed to the ladies' gallery, "and who, whenever the fair sex is mentioned, will be found to have the liveliest personal interest in the conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, I am about to propose to you the health of these three distinguished visitors. They are all admirable speakers, but Mr. Albert Smith has confessed to me that on fairly balancing his own merits as a speaker and a singer, he rather thinks he excels in the latter art. I have, therefore, yielded to his estimate of himself, and I have now the pleasure of informing you that he will lead off the speeches of the other two gentlemen with a song. Mr. Albert Smith has just said to me in an earnest tone of voice, 'What song would you recommend?' And I replied, 'Galignani's Messenger.' Ladies and gentlemen, I therefore beg to propose the health of Messrs. Albert Smith, Peter Cunningham, and Horace Mayhew, and call on the first-named gentleman for a song." Speech. Administrative Reform. Theatre Royal, Drury Lane, Wednesday, June 27, 1855. I cannot, I am sure, better express my sense of the kind reception accorded to me by this great assembly than by promising to compress what I shall address to it within the closest possible limits. It is more than 1800 years ago since there was a set of men who thought they should be heard for their much speaking. As they have propagated exceedingly since that time, and as I observe that they flourish just now to a surprising extent about Westminster, I will do my best to avoid adding to the numbers of that prolific race. the noble lord at the head of the government, when he wondered in Parliament about a week ago, that my friend, Mr. Layard, did not blush for having stated in this place, what the whole country knows perfectly well to be true, and what no man in it can by possibility better know to be true than those disinterested supporters of that noble lord, who had the advantage of hearing him, and cheering him night after night, when he first became premier. I mean, that he did officially and habitually joke, at a time when this country was plunged in deep disgrace and distress. I say, that noble lord, when he wondered, so much that the man of this age, who has, by his earnest and adventurous spirit, done the most to distinguish himself and it, did not blush for the tremendous audacity of having so come between the wind and his nobility, turned an airy period with reference to the private theatricals at Drury Lane Theatre. Now, I have some slight acquaintance with theatricals, private and public, and I will accept that figure of the noble lord. I will not say that, if I wanted to form a company of Her Majesty's servants, I think I should know where to put my hand on the comic old gentleman, nor that if I wanted to get up a pantomime, I fancy I should know what establishment to go to for the tricks and changes. Also, for a very considerable host of supernumeraries to trip one another up in, that contention with which many of us are familiar, both on these, and on other boards, in which the principal objects thrown about are loaves and fishes. But I will try to give the noble lord the reason for these private theatricals, and the reason why, however ardently he may desire to ring the curtain down upon them, there is not the faintest present hope of their coming to a conclusion. It is this. The public theatricals which the noble lord is so condescending as to manage are so intolerably bad, the machinery is so cumbrous, the parts so ill distributed, the company so full of walking gentlemen, the managers have such large families, and are so bent upon putting those families into what is theatrically called first business, not because of their aptitude for it, but because they are their families, that we find ourselves obliged to organize an opposition. We have seen the comedy of errors played so dismally like a tragedy, that we really cannot bear it. We are, therefore, making bold to get up the school of reform, and we hope, before the play is out, to improve that noble lord by our performance very considerably. If he object that we have no right to improve him without his license, we venture to claim that right in virtue of his orchestra, consisting of a very powerful piper, whom we always pay. Sir, as this is the first political meeting I have ever attended, and as my trade and calling is not associated with politics, perhaps it may be useful for me to show how I came to be here, because reasons similar to those which have influenced me may still be trembling in the balance in the minds of others. I want at all times, in full sincerity, to do my duty by my countrymen. If I feel an attachment towards them, there is nothing disinterested or meritorious in that, for I can never too affectionately remember the confidence and friendship that they have long reposed in me. My sphere of action, which I shall never change, I shall never overstep, further than this, or for a longer period than I do tonight. By literature I have lived, and through literature I have been content to serve my country, and I am perfectly well aware that I cannot serve two masters. In my sphere of action I have tried to understand the heavier social grievances, and to help to set them right. When the Times newspaper proved its then almost incredible case, in reference to the ghastly absurdity of that vast labyrinth of misplaced men and misdirected things, which had made England unable to find on the face of the earth an enemy 1/20th part so potent to effect the misery and ruin of her noble defenders as she has been herself, I believe that the gloomy silence into which the country fell was by far the darkest aspect in which a great people had been exhibited for many years. With shame and indignation lowering among all classes of society, and this new element of discord piled on the heaving basis of ignorance, poverty and crime, which is always below us with little adequate expression of the general mind, or apparent understanding of the general mind, in Parliament with the machinery of government, and the legislature going round and round, and the people fallen from it and standing aloof, as if they left it to its last remaining function of destroying itself. When it had achieved the destruction of so much that was dear to them, I did and do believe that the only wholesome turn affairs so menacing could possibly take was the awaking of the people, the outspeaking of the people, the uniting of the people in all patriotism and loyalty to effect a great peaceful constitutional change in the administration of their own affairs. At such a crisis this association arose. At such a crisis I joined it. Considering its further case, to be if further case could possibly be needed, that what is everybody's business is nobody's business, that men must be gregarious in good citizenship as well as in other things, and that it is a law in nature, that there must be a center of attraction for particles to fly to, before any serviceable body with recognized functions can come into existence. This association has arisen, and we belong to it. What are the objections to it? I have heard in the main but three, which I will now briefly notice. It is said that it is proposed by this association to exercise an influence, through the constituencies, on the House of Commons. I have not the least hesitation in saying that I have the smallest amount of faith in the House of Commons at present existing, and that I consider the exercise of such influence highly necessary to the welfare and honor of this country. I was reading no later than yesterday the book of Mr. Pepys, which is rather a favorite of mine, in which he, 200 years ago, writing of the House of Commons, says, "My cousin Roger Pepys tells me that it is matter of the greatest grief to him in the world that he should be put upon this trust of being a Parliament man, because he says nothing is done that he can see out of any truth and sincerity, but mere envy and design." Now, how it comes to pass that after 200 years, and many years after a reform bill, the House of Commons is so little changed, I will not stop to inquire. I will not ask how it happens that bills which cramp and worry the people, and restrict their scant enjoyments, are so easily passed, and how it happens that measures for their real interests are so very difficult to be got through Parliament. I will not analyze the confined air of the lobby, or reduce to their primitive gases its deadening influences on the memory of that honorable member who was once a candidate for the honor of your and my independent vote and interest. I will not ask what is that secretarian figure, full of blandishments, standing on the threshold, with its finger on its lips. I will not ask how it comes that those personal altercations, involving all the removes and definitions of Shakespeare's touchstone, the retort courteous, the quip modest, the reply churlish, the reproof valiant, the countercheck quarrelsome, the lie circumstantial, and the lie direct, are of immeasurably greater interest in the House of Commons than the health, the taxation, and the education of a whole people. I will not penetrate into the mysteries of that secret chamber in which the bluebeard of party keeps his strangled public questions, and with regard to which, when he gives the key to his wife, the newcomer, he strictly charges her on no account to open the door. I will merely put it to the experience of everybody here, whether the House of Commons is not occasionally a little hard of hearing, a little dim of sight, a little slow of understanding, and whether, in short, it is not in a sufficiency invalided state to require close watching, and the occasional application of sharp stimulants, and whether it is not capable of considerable improvement. I believe that, in order to preserve it in a state of real usefulness and independence, the people must be very watchful and very jealous of it, and it must have its memory jogged, and be kept awake. When it happens to have taken too much ministerial narcotic, it must be trotted about, and must be bustled and pinched in a friendly way, as is the usage in such cases. I hold that no power can deprive us of the right to administer our functions as a body comprising electors from all parts of the country, associated together because their country is dearer to them than drowsy twaddle, unmeaning routine, or worn-out conventionalities. This brings me to objection number two. It is stated that this association sets class against class. Is this so? Cries of no. No, it finds class set against class, and seeks to reconcile them. I wish to avoid placing in opposition those two words aristocracy and people. I am one who can believe in the virtues and uses of both, and would not on any account deprive either of a single just right belonging to it. I will use, instead of these words, the terms, the governors and the governed. These two bodies the association finds with a gulf between them, in which are lying, newly buried, thousands on thousands of the bravest and most devoted men that even England ever bred. It is to prevent the recurrence of innumerable smaller evils, of which, unchecked, that great calamity was the crowning height and the necessary consummation, and to bring together those two fronts looking now so strangely at each other, that this association seeks to help to bridge over that abyss, with a structure founded on common justice and supported by common sense. Setting class against class. That is the very parrot prattle that we have so long heard. Try its justice by the following example. A respectable gentleman had a large establishment, and a great number of servants, who were good for nothing, who, when he asked them to give his children bread, gave them stones, who, when they were told to give those children fish, gave them serpents. When they were ordered to send to the east, they sent to the west. When they ought to have been serving dinner in the north, they were consulting exploded cookery books in the south, who wasted, destroyed, tumbled over one another when required to do anything, and were bringing everything to ruin. At last the respectable gentleman calls his house steward, and says, even then more in sorrow than in anger, this is a terrible business. No fortune can stand it, no mortal equanimity can bear it. I must change my system. I must obtain servants who will do their duty. The house steward throws up his eyes in pious horror, ejaculates, good God, master, you are setting class against class. And then rushes off into the servants' hall, and delivers a long and melting oration on that wicked feeling. I now come to the third objection, which is common among young gentlemen who are not particularly fit for anything but spending money which they have not got. It is usually comprised in the observation, how very extraordinary it is that these administrative reform fellows can't mind their own business. I think it will occur to all that a very sufficient mode of disposing of this objection is to say that it is our own business we mind when we come forward in this way, and it is to prevent it from being mismanaged by them. I observe from the parliamentary debates which have of late, by the by, frequently suggested to me, that there is this difference between the bull of Spain and the bull of Nineveh, that, whereas, in the Spanish case, the bull rushes at the scarlet, in the Ninevite case, the scarlet rushes at the bull. I have observed from the parliamentary debates that, by a curious fatality, there has been a great deal of the reproof valiant and the counter-check quarrelsome, in reference to every case, showing the necessity of administrative reform, by whomsoever produced, whensoever, and wheresoever. I dare say I should have no difficulty in adding two or three cases to the list, which I know to be true, and which I have no doubt would be contradicted, but I consider it a work of supererogation. For, if the people at large be not already convinced that a sufficient general case has been made out for administrative reform, I think they never can be, and they never will be. There is, however, an old and disputable, very well-known story, which has so pointed a moral at the end of it, that I will substitute it for a new case. By doing of which I may avoid, I hope, the sacred wrath of St. Stephen's. Ages ago a savage mode of keeping accounts on notched sticks was introduced into the court of exchequer, and the accounts were kept, much as Robinson Crusoe kept his calendar on the desert island. In the course of considerable revolutions of time, the celebrated Cocker was born and died. Walkingham, of the tutor's assistant, and well versed in figures, was also born and died. A multitude of accountants. Book. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.